The Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129 presents America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture with Father Matt Malone and Kerry Weber.
Good day. You're listening to America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. I am Kerry Weber, executive editor for America Magazine.
And I'm Tim Reedy, sitting in for Father Matt Malone. Each week, we offer news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world, gathered by our team at America Magazine.
And one of those team members is with us today, Zach Davis, associate editor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kerry.
As we have noted in prior episodes, you may recognize Zach's voice from Jesuitical, our podcast for young, hip, lay Catholics.
Yeah, honestly, if you're not listening to Jesuitical, I don't know what you're doing at this point. So, yeah, check that
out. Well, with an attitude like that, everyone's tuning in, I'm sure.
Yeah,
the humble Zach Davis
that's right.
is with us
today. You can finish listening to this show, but then immediately after that, go download Jesuitical in your favorite podcast app.
I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
And now we're going to move on to our guest for today's show, who is Nathan Schneider. He is a contributing writer to our magazine, and he's a professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and the author of several books. And his article for us most recently is called How Can Activists Win More Than a Viral Moment? It's a crucial question, and here to answer it is Nathan Schneider. Welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be on again.
Thank you for being here. You start off the piece writing a bit about a weekend that you spent in the Pennsylvania Hills as a group of 50 activists from around the country kind of working on different issues and discussing what you had in common, how to organize. I wonder if you can tell us a bit about what were the origins of that particular event and why you were there.
It was the weirdest thing. Kind of a one-shot moment. I think it was in 2012 when, you know, in the wake of the 2011 uprisings around the world, and some people wanted to bring others together who were involved in a bunch of different efforts for, you know, change and justice and around the country. And it happened to be in this bizarre hotel in the middle of Pennsylvania along the highway, just because I guess the guy who owned the hotel was a kind of supporter of the event. One of the things that struck me about that was hearing from, I knew a bunch of these people from years past. I'd known their names. A lot of them were much older than me. As they told their stories of what got them into the work that they do, something struck me, which was that a lot of them had a story of success at the beginning, you know, and that had rooted everything else that they had done, that they had achieved something, that they had done something, you know, maybe not so big, maybe something small, but something that had real repercussions in the world. And that gave them the strength to go on and do their work. And that made me actually very troubled for my generation, you know, that was kind of coming up at that time, because so much of what we had been involved in, so much of what people around me had been involved in was creating viral spectacles, right? Not so much like achieving tangible change. And you know, that worried me.
Yeah, I think it's really easy to conflate the two, to conflate the attention that some act receives with the efficacy of it.
Yeah, and it points to some of the shifts that have been going on in how we do politics in recent decades, right? I mean, a kind of classic comparison between this. What it took for the and this is articulated, for instance, very well by the media scholar Zeynep Tufekci, that the difference between the what it took to create the March on Washington in 1963 for the civil rights movement and what it took to have the Women's March after the election of Donald Trump, right? The difference between those, both were massive convergences in Washington, D.C., but one took years of organizing and network building and fundraising and so forth. The other took a successful Facebook page. They look the same, but there's something very different about what they signify and what they represent.
What's interesting, you mentioned marches, because you talk here about some of the activists you've worked with saying that perhaps marches may be not the way to go, that this is something that people focus on. This is, a way to maybe garner media attention, but perhaps some people are rethinking that.
Yeah, well, you know, that comes in particular from this, from a mentor of mine, George Lakey, who's just published a wonderful book called How We Win, that looks at this. It's kind of a handbook for activists of all stripes. And one rule that he and others he's worked with sometimes make for themselves is no marches and rallies. You know, just get out of the ritual, because it forces you to say, okay, what would actually be powerful for us to do right now? What would be something that would make a meaningful difference in someone's life, rather than just kind of defaulting to the most obvious spectacle?
So what is there an example there that he points to, something that, you know, is not as showy, perhaps affects more change?
Well, one story he tells is a case of a campaign that they were conducting in Philadelphia against casinos. That was, people wanted to bring casinos to Philadelphia, and they were part of a campaign to stop that. And rather than just holding more marches and so forth, they actually did a kind of nonviolent search and seizure where they managed to obtain certain documents that revealed something about the other side that that really helped turn the tide of the campaign. Something, you know, not so different from the, you know, they didn't do a burning, but the draft card burning of the, you know, people like Father Dan Berrigan, yep. Father Phil Berrigan, right? You know, going to the kind of heart of the matter, creating an action that that reveals something deeper about the campaign at work, rather than simply that just kind of is a show of spectacle.
Now, Nathan, is there something with that marches are kind of safe to pull off nowadays? I don't know. You bring to mind Father Berrigan and, you know, him and the group that, you know, burned the draft cards in Vietnam. They went to jail for that, right? I mean, are activists as willing to do the things that are going to get them in trouble now?
Well, activists are certainly taking risks. I mean, the kinds of things that people were doing, and, you know, especially when I think of like the Standing Rock occupation, you know, trying to change our country's direction around fossil fuel extraction and indigenous rights. You know, that was a case where, you know, some of the most vulnerable people in our society took risks, tremendous risks, in order to stand their ground. But it's true, you know, the digital universe kind of insulates us often from those kinds of risks, and it's so much easier to just, you know, join a Facebook group than to step into action.
You talk about the differences between organizing the March on Washington and the Women's March. Do you see a difference in their legacies as well?
Well, we don't know really what the legacy of the Women's March is right now, but it does. I mean, it was so much a moment rather than a, you know, than a movement. I think there's, and we're still kind of understanding where this is going, but it was built. You know, you had to build an organization around the action in the case of the Women's March, rather than building an action around organizations and structures and momentum, which was happening in the context of 63. And that meant that, you know, in the context of 63, was part of a broader strategy that was leading to a particular place. Now, the Women's March at the same time, you know, I think did help contribute to significant gains around, you know, for instance, women's representation in Congress. Mm-hmm. And so it may be that this is just a kind of, you know, that there are paths to, you know, to similar effectiveness. They just might be different paths, different mechanisms that we're, you know, still learning to understand.
Do you have any like concrete like examples of viral moments, especially in the digital sphere, that we've seen recently that you know, we thought maybe was going to be a big deal and then sort of puttered out as time went by?
Well, one kind of famous example, right, is the Kony 2012 case. Do you remember that? This hugely viral video.
But maybe remind our listeners about Kony 2012.
It really relates to a kind of missionary tradition, actually. You know, somebody who was, you know, an American Christian goes to Africa, sees this, the use of child soldiers and this kind of horrific killing going on, and believes that his mission is to draw attention to it, and by that attention, the problem will be solved. And it ended up becoming this enormous sensation for about a week, and then kind of exploded in this classic fashion because, you know, there wasn't a strategy there, there wasn't a next step, there was kind of a superficial understanding of the problem. And, this is kind of a classic case, but I think we see this repeating over and over and over, where we're drawn to these kind of attention chambers. We're not so much drawn to building bonds of solidarity that last beyond the momentary attention.
Now, Nathan, maybe you can speak about, you know, at the beginning of the show, you were talking about how important the early kind of formational moments are for activists. Maybe you can speak about what that moment was for you, perhaps. I know you're involved in Occupy Wall Street. Was it that? Was it something else?
It kind of began before that. When I think of a founding moment, it was really. The wake of 9/11, and it was the wars that began after that. I was 17 at the time, and senior in high school, kind of just figuring out who I was and what I was about, and living in Washington D.C., where we had kind of felt the attack firsthand, the beginning of the war in Afghanistan was kind of the start, and then about a year later, the beginning of the Iraq War, and there was just a kind of deep sense of frustration and helplessness that I felt in that process. That sense of deep wrongness, and also a sense of a society unable to really come to terms with it. And so, I think of my formation as really beginning from that kind of frustration, and that I feel like I've spent much of my life since then trying to find more ways for people to be heard, to feel less helpless in their political lives.
Was there a mentor or someone that brought you into a particular activist community?
There were a number of them. I mentioned George Lakey before, who was a columnist when I was an editor of Waging Nonviolence, and certainly also Dan Berrigan and his community of Jesuits. When I moved to New York in 2008, a friend who was a monk, a Cistercian monk, introduced me to somebody who brought me to Dan Berrigan's house within the first weeks of my being there, and introduced me to not only to this community of Jesuits and friends, but also to other younger emerging activists with whom I started a website called Waging Nonviolence, which covers news of resistance movements around the world.
You mentioned in the piece there's sort of a difference between the communities that, activists that you've admired or who have mentored you, and, community that you've experienced in activist communities, and sort of the culture that exists now, where there's a lot of, rather than, inclusion and teaching and mentoring that goes on, there's a lot more sort of self-policing and calling out of people who sort of don't break rank.
Well, yeah, I think there's, that's certainly been a feature. I think that's starting to change. I think there's an interesting shift happening right now where, as opposed to some years ago, like in the phase of the 2011 movements around the world, there was a very anti-institutional turn, certainly on the left. The worst possible thing you could do was have anything to do with the Democratic Party. today, it's a moment where I think people are, a lot of those same people, as well as a new generation, are coming back to terms with institutions. I think that's a really interesting moment. You know, are people going to learn to live within institutional structures and gain the, you know, the powers and opportunities for solidarity that they offer? And that's also relevant to something like the Catholic Church. You know, when I think of my relationship to political formations, you know, it sometimes feels like my relationship with the Catholic Church, you know, it requires recognizing that this is a flawed entity, something that's made of human beings. And I'm going to tolerate that because there's a bigger purpose, for my participation in this and a greater meaning, something I can be within this that I just can't be on my own.
What's interesting, as you were talking earlier about your own formation, I was thinking about like generationally how this is playing out. Zach and Kerry are both millennials, and I think, Nathan, you're kind of a older millennial.
Yeah, right on the edge. I remember once being in grad school, and I was taught how I had to go to a session about how to teach these bizarre millennials, and I was the only one in the room who was actually, you know, made the cutoff. You know, it was a little anxiety producing.
Now, and I'm Gen X, which I think there was probably a little fatigue when I was growing up with the generation before us who was so activist. It was also a time of relative prosperity and peace in the 80s. But then you point out, you know, beginning in the 2000s, it's a time of war that it's still going on. So that is having effect on your generation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go ahead, Nathan.
You know, there was an article in the magazine recently about public repentance that was just so fantastic, and I appreciate it so much. That to me captured something that I think I was craving at that moment early on in the early 2000s, you know, in the midst of that, when the wrongness of the Iraq war just became so incredibly apparent and the society seemed unable to cope with it. That again felt to me like one of those moments where, you know, there's something related between the church and the society that, you know, that we had as a church had something to offer in terms of what it looks like to be able to say, you know, I'm not perfect in public life, that we have sin on our hands.
Yeah, that's Eve Tushnet's piece, for those who want to look that up online.
Nathan, I'm wondering if you have like a model movement right now in your mind of a group that is putting in the hard work, the discipleship of building community and building movements. Is there a model movement right now that you're looking to for how activists can look to?
Well, you know, I don't know about a model, but I can speak a little bit about what I'm involved in lately, which is around kind of building a new generation in the cooperative business movement. You know, this is building on something that that is a legacy in Catholic communities, but also far beyond that, and it's trying to do all these things at once. You know, on the one hand, trying to work within institutions, but also kind of pushing back and challenging them. It's an effort to, on the one hand, leverage this moment of change and polarization and dynamism in our politics, while at the same time trying to cut across some of those divides that seem to sort us into irreconcilable batches. Building a movement always requires living within contradiction because you're trying to reshape the categories of social life, and learning tolerance for that contradiction, I think, is kind of essential, and being able to keep your eye too as you do on the real, on the people around you, on things that you can do in everyday life that will actually make people's lives better, help them make their lives better.
Nathan, how does your own activism contribute to your prayer life and vice versa? Do you find that your prayer life helps to motivate your activism as well?
Well, I'm a real devotee of the Angelus prayer. That to me, you know, the three Hail Marys, the short little introduction. It's a short prayer, a prayer for I think for working people, for people who are in the middle of the world, who don't have much time, but who want to give their time over to the Lord and to have their time guided. That prayer is something that comes up for me multiple times a day, whenever I can make time for it. And in a moment of life where I've got kids and just very focused on the things that are not especially contemplative, that prayer is an incredible source of grace for me.
And a related question: is this a way to kind of, is prayer one way to avoid burnout? Because that is a kind of a hazard of the kind of being an activist, is just kind of, how do you persist? How does this become the work of a lifetime?
That's community, and prayer is part of community. But to me, the question of burnout, right, is about being part of a group of people who are in it for good, and who help each other do that. That was something that the community of Jesuits around Dan Berrigan was all about. They had a group called Kairos that. One of those Greek words for time that existed really above all to help people see the bigger picture, help people live for live and work toward a lifetime of commitment. I've seen so much burnout in my time covering and participating in work for social change, and the people who are able to avoid that are the people who are in relationship and who are intentional, about committing themselves in a sustainable way, in a way that has a Sabbath built in, right? That Sabbath might be the truest answer to that question.
And also, how do you do that with a family, like creating a community, but also having, as you do, young kids? Because I imagine that's a challenge as well.
Yeah, I was wondering, do you have to quit your day job to be an activist?
Well, fortunately, at the moment, I'm the beneficiary of a very generous family leave policy at my university. So actually, I'm currently doing full-time childcare. So I have, in a sense, quit my day job for the moment, just getting away for a little bit to take this call. But that's been a real blessing and also a real challenge. And I've been realizing how much of my life, especially as a man, has been oriented toward valuing myself for my, what I can do in a workplace, in public, and I haven't really learned how to value myself for what I can do in at home in taking care of a child, and I think I have a lot to learn about that, and it's been a beautiful and challenging process to do that.
Well, thank you so much for taking your time out of the day from all of that you are doing to speak with us. We really, truly appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for keeping me in the loop. I am so grateful for all that you all are doing.
And we're grateful for your work as well. Nathan Schneider is a contributing writer to America, and you can find his work at americamagazine.org. You can also buy his book, Everything for Everyone, The Radical Tradition That is Shaping the Next Economy. You can find more of our work at americamagazine.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, etc. And you can subscribe to the magazine by calling 1-800-627-9533. For Zach Davis, Tim Reedy, and myself, have a great day.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.